Okay, I have muted all, and everybody does have the ability to unmute themselves. So welcome all to this week's Q&A session. Guests, as always, are welcome at our meetings. And if you want to join the PC user group, I've pasted into the chat a link where you can go to join the group. So if you do unmute yourself to ask a question or make a comment, please remute yourself afterwards in order to keep noise down to a minimum. And I think that's it for the lead-ins for it. Later on this evening, PDF of the deck, the auto recording and the contents of the chat will go up on the website. And with that, I'll turn it over to Alan to lead us through tonight's deck. Alan, take it away.
Okay, thanks, Chris. Okay, so welcome to the November 2nd edition. First thing, just let me remind you that we'll have nothing prepared in the last 10 minutes, hopefully. That's our aim anyway. So if you have any questions that you want to ask, that's the time to do so. But you're also allowed to put them in the chat ahead of time, and Chris will queue them up for us. I'm talking about Chris. The first thing we have is a weird share.
I paste in the URL to this into the chat window if anybody's actually interested in reading about it. I thought this was pretty bizarre. Microsoft 365 has teamed up with Oreo Thins on this promotional gig where they are. I don't understand this co-branding on this at all. But there's information on the website and their blog about why they did this. They actually had it that you could actually sign up for something and they would actually send you some Microsoft 365 branded Oreo Thins along with what I would actually really like is that Clippy Dippy, which is a little thing to hold your Oreo when you're dunking it into milk so that you don't get your fingers wet, I guess. Unfortunately, when I went to the website, they were all sold out. So just a little bit of a humor. And if you want to read up on why Microsoft thinks that they should team up with Oreo, take a look at the website.
Maybe the club should create some OPCUG Clippy Dippies.
Yeah.
Take that to the board. with a box of Oreo cookies to pass around. Okay, thank you, Chris. As I say, a weird share. Okay, moving along, I have a computer basics item, and this is all about how to customize the Windows start screen. And you probably notice here that this is my start screen, and it is slightly customized. And there's a bunch of things you can do with the start screen. One of the things is you can actually make it bigger, and you can make it bigger in all kinds of different directions, so you just kind of hold the mouse on an edge or a corner and drag, and that will make the start screen bigger so you can get all of those tiles in where you would like them. And to add a tile, you basically find a program. Here's Cortana. If you right-click on the entry for Cortana, it pops up this context menu. And you'll notice one of the options is pin to start. I pin Cortana to the start menu. So if you click on pin to start, then you will find a tile on your start screen where you can start Cortana. If you don't like Cortana, which I don't particularly, I don't use Cortana. So if you right click on any of the tiles on the start screen, then it pops up this menu and it has unpin from the start. The bad thing about this is that when they first brought out Windows 10, Windows 8, one of those, and it used to have an option to get rid of all the tiles at once, and they seem to have got rid of that. So now when you load a fresh install of Windows, you probably notice on my start screen, I probably don't have any of the original tiles from the Windows default entries on the start screen. But you basically have to right-click on every icon and unpin it from the start. Anyway, that's how you can add and remove tiles from the start screen. The other thing you can do, if you right-click on any of the tiles, as well as unpinning it from the start, you may find that you have a resize menu. And it's very dependent on the actual tile, what kind of resizing you can do. But this is looking at this Photoscape X tile down here. And you notice that it's medium right now, but I can make it small or wide or large. So you pick a size that's good for you. And the other thing is that you're not restricted to just programs on the start screen. If you open up File Explorer and go to a folder, and if you right-click on the folder, so here I've taken my OPCUG Presentations folder, I've right-clicked on Presentations, it pops up the context menu, and down here I've got the option to pin this folder to the start, so I can find it pretty easily. So there's my folder pinned to the start. And then the next thing you can do is you can pick an item that you want to add to the start menu, but instead of dragging it into the existing area, if you like, if you pull it right down to the bottom of the menu until you see this horizontal bar, and then let go underneath that, what you've done is to create, you've added the, I've added Thunderbird to the start menu, but I've also created a new group. And you can see here that if I click on name group, left click, I can actually rename the, or I can give the group a name. So I call it email. And then lo and behold, I now have a group of email programs, I guess. And my first entry there is Thunderbird. And you also notice that you don't have to name the group. This is clearly a group here, but I haven't added a name for it. So those are all kinds of things that you can do to make your start screen bigger, add and subtract items, make the tiles bigger, create groups, and all kinds of wonderful things.
One thing I could add to that is you can rearrange your icons. You can drag and drop them anywhere you want. So you can arrange them into different groups or move them around, however it suits your needs.
Yeah, you probably noticed that I've got a bunch of LibreOffice options here and a bunch of Microsoft Office options here. Okay. So moving along, Chris has a share on a PC management program.
Yeah, I came across this on a Twitter post, I guess about a week and a half ago or so, and looked into it. Looked kind of interesting. So it's a PC optimizer or cleanup utility that is put out by Microsoft, and it's in public beta version 1.2.3.2 currently. And these are three screens that come up during the installation of the program itself. And so you can see they say it will do full system security checkup. It is super fast. I don't know about super fast virus removal. And they say a one-click speed boost. And technically, yes, there is one click that you can do, but it doesn't actually do everything that you really need it to do within the program. So a little bit of marketing at work there. So next. So to install it, and I posted this into the chat, you go to pcmanager.microsoft.com, and you can see the wonderful screen that you get up. And it is a Chinese website that you actually get. Thankfully, I was using Google Chrome, and Google Chrome Next offers to translate the website for you when they see that it's not in your native language. So I clicked on English, and sure enough, I then got buttons that said free download, and there's a free download over on the left-hand side as well. So you just click on the free download and install the program. Next. So once it's been installed, there is a system tray icon, so down near the clock in the bottom right-hand corner, and it just looks like the Windows logo, four squares with one in dark blue and the other three in light blue. You click on that, and if you happen to have it hidden, you might find it under the chevron where hidden system icons reside. And next. So here's what you end up getting is the main screen. Thankfully, it's not in Chinese. And so it comes up and it offers to boost PC's performance. And it comes up on the cleanup tab. There's two tabs and it comes up on the cleanup tab. So there's the one-click speed boost. And yes, it does work as one click. And all it seems to do is deleting temporary files, and it can free up some memory. Now, one thing I caution people or let them know about with speed boosters that promise to free up memory, Windows actually has a memory manager that does a very good job on its own of cleaning up memory as is needed. And if you boost things by freeing up memory, you may well be impacting the performance of Windows because, you know, there are, you know, what's the point of having free memory? You want your memory in use to your benefit. And if Windows sees that there is free memory available, it will go ahead and use it for caching and various other things like that to the benefit of the overall performance of the computer. So I don't bother with things like freeing up memory. I think that's a waste of time in modern Windows. Next. So there's four main sections under this boosting performance. So there's a health check, storage management, process management, and startup apps, and we'll look at each of these four. Next. Okay, so if you go into the cleanup section, there's a whole bunch of categories of things that you can actually clean up. And so Windows cache, browser cache, and I presume that in that they're actually talking about only Microsoft browsers. So Edge, I think they're actually physically removing Internet Explorer from computers now, so I don't know if it does anything there. It'll clean up temporary files that your system is not currently using, system log files, recent file lists, which I think is a real waste of time to clean up that. But at any rate, it's there. Next. And then they have a potential issues section, and I thought this was really, really weaselly words. You know, looking for general items. I don't know what they mean by general items. I don't know what they mean about potential issues. I don't know what it means when they say treats were found. When I clicked on this, it actually reset my hosts file. So if you don't know what a host file is, don't worry about it. But anybody who does know what a host file is, that's not a very polite thing to reset the host file back to the default, which basically is an empty file. And then they have an option. Fortunately, it's not pre-checked for you of reset default browser to Edge. So they are continuing the Microsoft tradition of trying to beat up on anybody using anything other than Edge for browsing. But as I say, fortunately, it's not pre-checked for you. So you'd have to actually go and say, oh, yeah, that sounds like a good idea, if you indeed feel it's a good idea. Next.
I presume that treats found is supposed to say threats found.
Oh, I never even thought of that. Yeah, you're probably right. Threats found. I'm not sure what the heck is this, treats. Yeah, you're probably right.
That works in Chinese, right?
I don't know. Yeah, interesting. That's hilarious. Then in the...
it's Halloween, you know.
Yeah, right. In the health check, there's also a startup section in there, and this was on that same screen as the previous one. It's just bigger than could fit on the screen. So the third section, it's interesting because they say startup programs to disable. And they missed 12 of 28 startup apps that are actually listed on the startup tab in Task Manager. You know, I have 28 on my computer at that point in time, and this list missed 12 of them. I have no clue why. And you can see the highlighted ones on the right-hand side are the ones that it missed, but comparing it to Task Manager startup. So I don't know why. And SysInternals auto runs can find much, much more that gets auto-started on your computer if you're really interested in managing startup apps. So I don't know why there's a shortcoming on that. Maybe it's because it's in a public beta. I don't know. Anyhow, next.
No. You can't possibly live without Bing wallpaper.
Yeah, that's right. Okay, then we get into the storage manager, and this is actually definitely worthwhile. So there are two things on here, that the deep cleaning and the manage large files. The manage apps and storage sense just actually call the standard setup or settings app for those. Next. So yeah, that just calls up settings apps. It doesn't even come within the app itself here. And storage sense just brings you to settings, system, storage, storage sense. So nothing magical about that, except it's, I guess, a convenient way of getting to it. I don't know. Anyhow, next.
Jeff says, it's ironic. It allows you to turn off startup apps, but automatically installs itself as a startup app.
Yeah, it's actually not a bad idea to have it. If you're interested in it, it's a good idea to have it actually starting up, because it's always running and looking for things that it can actually clean up for you. So personally, I think it's good. You can easily turn that off if you don't like it. You can turn it off within the app, no problem at all. So now getting into the storage manager, there's a deep cleanup, and this is actually pretty cool. So you can go in, you can see some of the things that it can actually do cleanups for. And let me just get on to, so next. So the first one on the list there, Windows Update Cleanup, there is only one other way I know of to do Windows Update Cleanup, and that's to use the app called Disk Cleanup. It's been around for a long time, but it's still there. And although it can be anything that it can clean up, typically can be cleaned up by a number of other methods. Disk cleanup, the only thing up until now that you could not clean any other way was Windows Update Cleanup. Now it's built into this PC manager, which is kind of neat. Next.
And in disk cleanup, don't you have to run system files to do the update?
Yeah, so you have to go into it, and then you have to click on cleanup system files, and it reloads and then gives you the option to do it. And this can clean up huge amounts of space. On some computers I've looked at, Windows Update Cleanup can clean up like 5 or 6 gigabytes worth of files that are sitting there totally useless on your system. Next. Okay, so down in the web cache, they do have the Edge cache. And one thing I found kind of interesting here is you can actually get details as to what is in the cache, which most cleanup apps, they just say, you know, you're using, you know, 500 megabytes in the cache, but they don't tell you what's in the cache. I'm not sure how useful this is, but it does actually allow you to get in and see exactly what's going to be cleaned up in the various caches that it can do a cleanup on. Next. So then the next one is the manage large files, and I find this to be quite useful as well. So you can see in the top section, you can choose a size. You just have 4 sizes that you can choose. You can't magically go in and say, well, I want things that are bigger than 2 gigabytes or, you know, 500 megabytes or anything like that. You choose one of the 4 sizes categories that are there. And then in the bottom part, you can pick up the type of file that you want. So you can look at just your documents or pictures or things like that, or you can do others, which will pick up executable files and basically everything on that. So once you've chosen what you want, you click on View and File Explorer. Next. Now, one thing I'll point out is that it's only going to handle the C drive, or the drive where Windows is installed on is the only drive that this will actually do this management for. You click on the File Explorer, and then next, it'll actually bring up a view in File Explorer, which is that customized view of looking at particular, larger than a particular file size, and the different categories of files. And then you can go in and you can, you know, I suggest going to the View tab, sort it by size or date modified or whatever makes most sense for you to be able to look at the files and decide what it is you want to do a cleanup. And then you can right-click on any of them. You can find the properties of it. You can find out where it's installed or that particular file and so forth to do the cleanup. Now, I do caution, be careful cleaning anything that you didn't create and put on your computer. However, I point out here, I found a long-forgotten 57-megabyte installation file that I definitely don't need, and I had just forgotten about the fact that it was even there. So it was kind of cool that this Manage Large Files would allow me to go in and discover some of this clutter on my drive that I can clean up. So the next is process management, and this is nothing that Task Manager doesn't allow you to do. Again, just like the startup programs, it was only showing 27 of 190 processes that are actually running on my computer at the time, and that was not counting the 110 Windows processes that were listed in Task Manager. And I'm wondering if maybe what they're doing is they're trying to limit it to processes that they figure are safe to end. And anything that is not on the list maybe are processes that they think you really shouldn't be messing with this process. I'm not sure. But it's another way to do it. Now, I think ending a process by clicking on one of those end buttons is a, if we go back to the Q&A where I talked about ways of ending programs, this is the one impolite way of closing a program. It does not allow a program to close where it cleans up after itself, where if you have an a changed document, it offers you the opportunity to save the document before exiting. This strictly terminates the process in memory. Very impolite way of doing it, but it is a handy way if you have a process that is hung and it won't close through any of the normal ways. You can come in here and you can try to just kill the process. So useful, but nothing the Task Manager doesn't give you. Then there's scan your PC for threats under the security tab. Next. And so you can go to Windows Update and it will actually just bring you all of the things that are due under Windows Update, including things that are listed as optional driver updates. So this is something that probably most people never even look at because they go to Windows, if they go to Windows Update ever, they just say, oh, okay, what's available, and they update it. But they never bother to check on drivers. So this is exposes it a little bit. I'm not sure if it's that big a deal, but it does bring something to the surface. Next. And then under browser protection, it does have listed there, it's whatever your current default is, and then you can actually turn on the blocking of the change by malicious apps if you want to do that. And I think, yeah, so that's, you know, you can change your default browser from here as well. I don't know if under Windows 11 this does a better job of changing from Microsoft Edge to change all of the different file types and protocols and so forth in one fell swoop, or whether it just does the typical pathetic job under Windows 11 if you want to choose a browser other than Microsoft Edge. I'm not sure. I don't have Windows 11 to test it. Next. So in summary, I think that it does have some interesting features. I really hope that Microsoft does release it as a final product. I think it would be really cool if they rolled it into the Power Toys, just have it available there as another Power Toy. I have used the in-app feedback option to suggest that they actually do that. Can it replace things like Windows Disk Cleanup? Yeah, but only for Drive C. Can it replace Windows Storage Sense? Yeah, but not Storage Sense's automation. Storage Sense can actually automate certain cleanups as disk space gets low, or on a periodic basis. You can say like once a month or something, do a run and clean up stuff. Can it replace CC Cleaner or C Cleaner? Only partially. I use CCleaner to do a fairly comprehensive cleanup of things like temporary files, my browser caches, Thunderbird, compress the databases, various things like that. I think CCleaner does a much more comprehensive cleanup, and it'll handle other apps like Thunderbird, so it'll only do a partial job at that. So at this point, I think you still need a lot of different utilities to do a proper cleanup on your computer. However, maybe this will actually grow into something that is a little bit more comprehensive and a little bit more useful. So that's all I have on that. It's in public beta, so feel free to download it. I have had no issues with it on the negative side. And so if anybody else tries it out and if you have any feedback on it, you could bring it forward at a future Q&A.
Hey, Chris. So Tom notes that everything is useful to find and delete big files.
Yeah.
Everything being the utility program of the same name. And it's useful because by default, it lists all of the files and folders by size with the biggest foot. So it's pretty easy to find the really big files that are on your system.
Yeah, that's what I find with a lot of the cleanup utilities. A lot of them will do a partial job. Most of them will do something very, very well. There doesn't seem to be one utility so far that will do everything all in one app. I'm sort of hopeful that this program could actually grow into that, but we'll see.
And Jeff has a note of caution here. He says, if you happen to put a large file in your OneDrive directory and you have a slow internet speed and you run the deep clean before the file has fully synced, you might find that the upload gets nuked and starts all over again.
Yep.
And go on, go ahead.
No, that's it. Yep.
And Jeff had noted on the start screen cleanup that in the Windows Store there's an app called WinTiler 2, and it allows you to add programs to the start menu, but also custom icons, so you can use image files rather than the defaults that Microsoft gives you. So it makes it lets you make the start screen more aesthetically pleasing. We like aesthetically pleasing. And Serge Rit says you can unpin group from start by right-clicking on the name of each group one by one if you want to clear all of them. All right, so that I guess you can clear a whole bunch of icons in a group by unpinning the group.
Oh, that's cool.
And
I didn't know that.
You can do that. Okay, so thanks, Chris, for that. And moving along, the next two items are going to be screen shares. So while the other people are running their screens, I just want to remind you that once they've finished, we will basically be in a any other questions type period. So this is going to be the last 10 or so. So if you have any questions, put them in the chat window, or open your mic when we're finished and ask your question directly, and we'd love to hear from you. So two things coming up. First of all, we're going to have Bob Harris, who's going to talk about some keyboard shortcuts. And then following that, we'll have Tom Trottier talking about YuMi, the multi-boot USB program. So, Bob, if you want to share your screen, and we'll be going to this slide. I think you have to unmute your microphone maybe too.
That's very good. Thank you, Alan. So this is under the keyboard shortcuts of the basic section. And a few weeks ago, Alan German discussed keyboard shortcuts. So I hope by now everybody is using using Control-C and Control-V. They're important shortcuts we should all be using. I have three or four more for you here today. The first one is very easy to remember. If you're typing an email or in a Word document, highlight your text, Control-B will make your text bold. Just remember, Control-B makes your text bold. And now I have one that's easy to remember, but nobody uses, because no one knows it exists. Most people don't even know this program, that this exists. Only one person in 10 knows this shortcut. So I'm going to make you the person in yellow. You'll be the person in yellow that you will know. This information is as per Daniel Russell. He's a research scientist at Google and teaches at Stanford University. Here we go. This is the one shortcut only one person in 10 knows. How do you quickly find words or phrases in a Word document, a web browser, or a PDF, or almost anything? Many folks spend hours or even half an hour, many, many minutes searching through stuff. Just press Control-Find. And you'll go right to your, it'll open a little box in the top right of the window, type in your phrase or word, you go right to it. Now, in some programs, you'll have a different search window, but I'd say 85 or 90% of the time, as long as the PDF file is in actual words, not a picture, actual text in there, it'll find that. It'll save you a lot of time. Okay. I know you're all thrilled about this. I have one more that's even bigger. We've all done this. I just did it again. I hit something, hit the wrong key or whatever. I have no idea what happened. I'm in trouble. But no worries. Control Z will undo almost anything. So no matter what you're doing here, it won't undo a saved file, but it'll undo almost anything you can do. So keep it in mind, Control-Z is certainly fantastic. I know you want to use this every day. And with this one, If you have pressed Control Z and you change your mind, Control Y redo. This isn't quite as universal, but it may work for you if you want to go back to where you were before. So that's the short of these ones here. In summary here, let's go through these. Control B makes your text bold. Control S will find things for you. My favorite is Control Z. I use it all the time. Now, if you use Control Z, you'll learn to love it. And soon, you'll want to use this Control Z in everyday life. You'll find yourself doing this. And here, I want to thank Alan Druman for this graphic. I love this graphic. It's the best one of the little slides here. So under Quick Basics here, look at your fun, have fun, and thank you all.
Hey, thanks. Thanks, Bob.
Thank you.
Chris has noted that Outlook uses Control and F to forward an email, so they use F4 as find, which isn't terribly helpful because nobody can remember it. Now, B really likes your Control F tip. Tom notes that Control Shift Z will undo the undo. And Natalie wants to know if Control and Y will work for most programs.
Give it a try. It isn't as universal, I believe, anyway, but Control Z, I think you're 85%. Whatever I do, I love it.
Okay, thanks. Okay, so Tom, why don't you share right away and unmute your mic.
I can't share. I haven't been given host.
You should be host. Oh, did I not? I thought I had. Hang on a second.
He said he did.
I said I did, but it looks like not. So there you go. Now you should be able to. Sorry about that.
You muted your mic again, Tom.
Can you see that?
Yeah, that's good.
Okay. Yummy is yummy. And it stands for your USB multi-boot installer. USBs have grown in size way more than bootable images or ISOs have. You can get USBs in the size of 512 gigabytes, and I'm not sure, they're probably going bigger. And one of the advantages of big USB sticks Or, for example, or as an alternative, SD cards. You can also use SD cards as well as USB sticks. And so you can create your own toolkits with bootable disk images, things like Live or Linux distributions that you want to load up and install. You can put a variety of Windows on there. You can go back to Windows 95 if you want and reboot in Windows 95 if you have the ISO. You can also put in the troubleshooting tools. Now, there are three Yummy variants, and these are XFAT, Legacy, and UEFI, or UEFI. XFAT is for 32 gigabyte media, or if you have one file on there that's more than 4 gigabytes, and you can use it for machines that boot that have a BIOS or a UEFI. UEFI? I don't know. How do you pronounce that? Anyway, that's one flavor. Another flavor is Legacy, which is for NTFS or FAT32, but it's a BIOS boot only. And then you have UEFI for FAT32, which is good for a BIOS or UEFI boot. Yummy supports search for the most recent versions of what you want to boot. Sorry, what's the difference between UEFI and BIOS boots? Either of these in your PC's read-only memory, they start your PC hardware, they detect memory and media, they also do a power-on self-test, and they often support updating some settings of a variety of choices. And also, the most important thing they do, probably, is they load the operating system from the media, they start it, and they also support calls to the hardware ongoing. BIOS is the basic input-output system, and this basically started in 1975, even before the IBM PC. And UEFI is the Unified Extensible Firmware Interface from 2005 onwards. And the advantages of that over BIOS are they have greater security, it handles bigger disks, it has a fancy UI, is written in an upper high-level language, C, rather than assembler language, and it can be 32 or 64-bit, depending on what your machine supports. It took years for adoption, but now it's ubiquitous. So, how do you add bootable ISOs to your USB drive? First of all, you have to prepare your USB drive. All the current content gets erased on that USB drive, so if there's anything you want to keep, put it somewhere else. But if it's already a Yummy drive, then you can add stuff to it. And here is where you do it. This is what shows up when you start Yummy. Choose the particular disk drive, the USB thing that you want to actually put the Yummy drive on. And once you click that, then what it does after that is go to here, and it gives you a little bit more details of the drive, and it gives you the latest version, and then it initiates it as a Yummy drive and formats it so that when you put it in, it will boot Yummy and then give you the choice of what you really want to do. If you're adding to an existing Yummy drive, this is what shows up. This is your disk, and you can see you have to click that. You're in uninstaller mode. There's a it doesn't show up here. You're in uninstaller mode, and then you can put here. You can actually delete pieces that you've already put on. But it shows you what you already have, and if you scroll down, you can see more. Now, what you want to do to put stuff on your Yummy USB drive is you go here and you choose what you want to put on there. Now, this actually gives you a whole bunch of choices. Ubuntu, Kubuntu, and you can see from the scroll bar that there's lots and lots and lots more. These are all varieties of Linux here, but Debian's there, Fedora, OpenSUSE, et cetera, et cetera. So there's a variety of distributions you can put on there. In fact, Yummy was created mainly so you could put a whole bunch of Unix or Linux distributions on there and boot them as you wanted, either to install them or to use them as live Linux distributions that can run from the USB. So what you want to do is you can select a distribution to put on D. One of these things that it, one of these things you can choose is called is DBAN, which is a hard drive nuker. Basically, it erases everything that's on your drive and puts garbage in its place. So if you're throwing away a drive or sending it off to somebody else to use or selling it or something, DBAN is a good thing to get rid of all the stuff. Now, one of the things it does here is you can visit the DBAN homepage. And you can visit it, and then you can download it, put it in a particular folder, and then you can load it into your Yummy drive. You can also, there are some of those links. It will give you an actual download link, and that will actually start you on. It will, instead of going to the homepage, it will actually go and download the file for you. And we're nearing the end. In fact, we're at the end. Once you've loaded all these things into your USB, then you can boot from your USB. But you may need to tell the BIOS or UEFI in the settings to boot from the USB first. This is usually done by going into the settings by holding down a key when you boot, which is usually F2 or F12 or maybe escape. It really depends on your machine, but you can put a whole bunch of stuff on a 57 gigabyte FAT32 drive.
Do you know what happens if the distro that you want to load is not available in that list?
You can also load or I believe you can drag and drop any ISO. It could be a Unix distribution, a Linux distribution, or it could be anything, any kind of ISO. You can drag in here, and it will put it on Yummy. One of the other things it does is in this thing here, you can see Ubuntu, Linux, Mint, CentOS. All of these --- are categories in the Yummy drive. And if you go into the Yummy drive, you will see those. And further down, you can see system tools and Windows distributions and stuff like that. So that they're all, instead of having like a list of, you know, 65 different distributions all in a row, you get them categorized by Ubuntu, Linux, Mint, CentOS, Debian Live, Fedora, OpenSUSE, system tools, Windows, et cetera, et cetera. But you can also put your own ISOs in there by just by dragging and dropping, I believe, or by browsing.
So Tristan notes that there's an interesting competitor called Ventoy.
Yes, there's some mention of Ventoy in Yummy. They seem to use similar methods. I'm not sure. I haven't looked into Ventoy, so I don't know about it. But apparently they, at least Yummy, recognizes Ventoy, and it may have some cooperation with it in some way, but I haven't looked into that.
And Tristan also says, for the adventurous tinkerers, the IODD-2541 looked pretty fascinating. There's a bunch of links there for anybody who wants to check on that. Okay, so thanks very much, Tom.
Are there any questions that other people want to ask? That you can do it on audio if you like.
No, those were the only things. Basically, comments.
Yeah, folks, you can unmute yourself if you want to comment on anything or ask a question.
You can also just press the space bar to talk.
So there is a question here from Cesarik Tom. Say you want to run Windows XP from Yumi, and I suppose you need a license.
You need a Windows license, I presume. But if you have your Windows XP on a CD, you can make that into an ISO and load it into a Yumi USB.
Okay, thanks very much. So we have one question in the chat from Bob Harris. He says he likes to and uses GreenShot screen capture. He says, is Snagit really worth $81.45 Canadian? He understands it's much better. And I think we have a Snagit guru on the line.
Well, I don't know. There may be somebody on there that's a guru. I'm a user. I've been a user of Snagit for quite a few years, and there are some things that I really, really do like about Snagit. I use it all the time. But it definitely has some advantages. Head to head, I don't know if it's worth $81.45 Canadian. If you use it really extensively and you're using it for documentation and, official uses where you want things to match up in one screenshot to another, you want to build templates that allow you to automate processes of creating screenshots and so forth, there are definitely some advantages to it. For the average casual user, I would be willing to bet that GreenShot is perfectly adequate. At some point, I might do something on Snagit just to show some of the things that I think are advantages to the program. But only you can decide if it's worth that extra amount. They do have, I believe it's a 30-day trial version, so you can always download and try it out. They have a lot of videos on their website that talk about various features and how to use them effectively and things like that. So if you're interested at all in an advanced screenshot program, I would suggest starting with their videos and then download the program and try it out.
Just looking in the operating system because Windows has Snipping Tool, which works really well, and Linux has Screenshot, which does the same job. So they're available on zero cost. I'm noting that a program called ShareX is very, very powerful. And Tristan says, for quick and easy screenshots, try using the Windows key, Shift, and S. Sorry, somebody's trying to cut in there.
Yes, ShareX is very powerful. And what I like about it is that you can have it automatically go to Irfan or any other editor to automatically edit and show it. The other advantage of ShareX is that when you want to share, you can either share a rectangular portion of the screen, or you can choose any of the many windows or sub-windows or panels within a screen and just choose those, which is what I did when I created the PowerPoint on Yumi.
So Stuart says, is anybody still using Patch My PC? Now his copy got updated last week, and when he ran it today on his laptop, it wiped out Skype. Hey, good update, Stu. I don't use Patch My PC, so I can't say anything about that. If anybody does wants to chip in, now's your chance. And if you have any other questions, now's your chance. The chat window is empty, I believe. Boy, last 10.
Well, we are just about on to the last 10, yeah. Just on Stu's last comment about Patch My PC, I've been using Sectir's VulDetect, which I don't think it's really an ideal sort of program. It does require that it doesn't really notify you when there are updates available. But it seems to do a pretty decent job of when you load the program, it will actually tell you what it's accumulated on your computer in terms of vulnerabilities that are still on your PC. One of the things that I really want is a good vulnerability management program rather than an update manager. I don't want to be told just that, oh, there's a newer version of the program. I only want to know if it's a newer version that it actually fixes security vulnerabilities is what I'm interested in. And that's one thing that Sectair's Vault Detect really does concentrate on, security vulnerabilities as opposed to any other form of update. It's not a bad program. It actually comes out of a bunch of people who worked for Secunia, and Secunia used to have a wonderful program called I forget what it was called now. Personal CSI. Software Inspector. Yeah, Personal Software Inspector. It was a great program, and it was free for personal use, and they had a commercial program for enterprises, and they dropped the personal version, and some of their employees started up this Sectair Vault Detect program, and it's been running for quite a few years now. If anybody's interested, I've done a presentation before, I think at Q&A, but check out the program if you're interested in a vulnerability management program.
So Jeff says that he has security cameras, but there's no Windows-based app for them. He can access the cameras off his Android phone, so through an Android app, but it would be helpful if he could get them on his Windows machine. So he's asking, is anybody using an Android emulator that might help access his security cameras?
Windows 11 has an Android emulator now, does it not? I don't know. Yeah, Lawrence?
I don't think Jeff's into Windows 11.
No, okay.
Yes, it does. That'll be one of the things I'll be covering next week.
Okay.
Stuart says BlueStacks is the grandpappy of Android emulators. And Tom says Google provides emulators. Anybody using these emulators, and do they work? I presume they work. Are they useful? Stuart says no. He just knows about BlueStacks.
They emulate particular devices, so you want to actually look at the provider of the device. So Google provides emulators for Pixels.
Yeah, so it's emulating a phone or a tablet, I guess. That would be okay if he can run the app on the emulated device. That would do the job, presumably. Okay, well, I have a question. My netbook computer from the dark ages, I haven't used it for a year, I must admit, suddenly decides it's not going to connect to the Wi-Fi anymore. And it basically just says, can't connect to that network. How do I fix it? Or is it a hardware failure? The device says the device is working. The device manager says the device is working. The driver is up to date according to Windows. But when I try and connect, it just says, can't connect to that network.
First thing I would try is tell it to forget that network. So you did that? Okay. Because I've heard of that being messed up before, where you get some configuration change that it is trying to connect using old parameters and forget this device should wipe out all of that information. But if that didn't help.
And I think it's worse than that, Chris, because it also won't connect on Linux.
Okay.
Oh, heavens.
Yeah, so that's really bad. I mean, that suggests it's a hardware problem to me if it won't connect on either OS.
Yeah, did you try connecting to any other network?
Not yet, no.
Yeah.
Have you checked your home network that you want to connect it to?
Well, everything else is connecting to it.
I know, but some netbooks and so on are limited to G Wi-Fi or N Wi-Fi,
and this one there, yeah.
And you may want to check your the setup of your router that in fact it's allowed to connect to in. Because sometimes you get a new router in and it's fancy dancy, you want it to go fast, and you tell it to, don't bother with these N or G or A connections. You want it to connect AC, you want to connect Wi-Fi 5, Wi-Fi 6, onwards and upwards, but okay, that doesn't connect to the slow network.
That's worth checking, because this is a new modem since I use this netbook. So
kudos,
very
Tom.
Suspicious.
Kudos, Tom.
I presume, Alan, that you have rebooted the router.
No.
Oh, well, that's always a thing that's worth trying.
Don't do that while my wife's watching tennis.
Yeah,
right. A surpriser.
So Natalie says, how can she know if the drivers for her hardware, monitor, printer, external microphone, camera, and so forth, will be compatible with Windows 11? Do I need to go to each hardware site to see if drivers are available? Lawrence?
Yeah, I'm thinking. I don't, you know. It is likely that there will be no problems, but it all depends. I'm thinking to Michelin's form emails in regards to her looking for a book scanner. And yeah, you know, if you have a unique piece of equipment, then who knows? It's a bigger gamble. But if you have pretty standard stuff that's been bought in the last 5 years, I've not heard of any problems. And I know Microsoft keeps on mentioning that, oh, we did something with Windows 11 and we're going to fix it and blah, blah, blah. And they have, and everything works out in the end. So if you had something from less than 5 years, you should be okay, is the general thought.
Yeah,
they haven't really changed the driver model from Windows 10 to Windows 11. Natalie mentioned that going from XP to Win 8 had to change everything. And, yeah, there was a big change in the driver model going into even the Win 7 kernel. And especially with Windows XP, you would have been running 32-bit, and probably now you're running 64-bit, and that definitely requires different drivers. But I think certainly a monitor would be no problem at all. Microphone would be no problem. Camera, presumably USB-based, anything USB-based shouldn't be an issue at all. Printers can be a little bit trickier. So it's definitely worth going to your printer manufacturer's website and see what they've got in terms of updated drivers and so forth. Scanners would be another one that would be checked with the manufacturer to see if there are updates. But by and large, anything USB-based, generally speaking, outside of printers, generally should be fine. Printers, even those, if you've got a Windows 10 driver working, and it's highly likely that either the existing driver will work or there will be an updated Windows 11 driver. On the update, if you're updating, Windows should be doing a not bad job on checking for compatibility of existing drivers on your system and leaving in place any drivers that are needed, that they don't have a Windows 11 specific driver for. But drivers are a bit of a bugaboo with Windows for sure. It's just I don't think that the driver model has really changed from Windows 10 to Windows 11. So I don't expect that you would run into any problems.
There was a question earlier about whether we were recommending to wait before updating to Windows 11. My solution to that and the driver issue, make a disk image of your system, update to Windows 11. It doesn't work. Restore the disk image, and you're back to square one in 15 minutes.
And to Alan's point, that is very good. But I would just add that two things. One, with Windows 11, the internal version number is still referencing 10 point whatever. So, and why that's important is because a lot of software base their compatibility on certain digits within that version number. So Microsoft has wisely, I guess, had kept it the programming version code, if you want to call it that, to 10 point whatever. The other thing is that if your system is saying, hey, I'm ready to go to Windows 11, the commentary is that Windows, Microsoft has already checked out the various peripherals that you're using, and it would not allow you to move up to Windows 11 in most cases. There's never an absolute guarantee that, but long story short, if your system says, hey, I'm ready to be updated to Windows 11, chances are you'll be okay. But then consider very much consider Alan's comment that you should have a full backup, image backup, before you proceed.
Okay, thanks. So we've hit the witching hour here. So I think we're kind of about ready to wrap up. We've run out of questions, I think, on the chat window there. So next week there is no Q&A because November the 9th is going to be our regular monthly meeting. And as we've been talking tonight, next week Lawrence is going to be talking about Windows 11. So all of your questions from today will be answered by this time next week. Lawrence is also our program director, and he's looking for suggestions and especially for speakers for upcoming meetings. So if you have any bright ideas about what you'd like to hear about at monthly meetings, then send us a note and we will be sure to pass it along to Lawrence. And then, as I said, next week there's no Q&A, so the next Q&A is on November the 16th, which is 2 weeks, so that gives you lots of time to think up your questions and sort out your PowerPoint decks to share all the wonderful information that you wish to do so with your friends and fellow members. And I think that's everything I have, so I hope everybody enjoyed tonight. We had a good mix of stuff. A lot of interesting discussion at the end there. So we'll see you next week at the Windows 11 meeting.
Thanks, folks.
Night.
Arrivederci.